these programs. So this bill is needed to create a task force to promote co-location and integrated services and to further identify more barriers to collaboration and to develop a model contract, identify examples of where collaboration is needed and is successful. So that is the quick rundown, and with me I have Ms. Abderholden with NAMI to testify quick and answer questions.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill of Minnesota, and we are very, very supportive of this legislation. You know, mental health treatment is important for children, and children don't exist in a vacuum. So you can't say, well, we're going to actually educate you in the morning and treat your mental illness in the afternoon. You really have to kind of do both together. We do have some school districts that have been very successful in integrating that treatment with education, and other districts that are told, frankly, by attorneys that you can't do that, there's too many liability issues, we don't know how to contract for that. And so what we thought is if we brought together a task force with kind of the best thinkers in this area and people who've been successful in doing it, identify the barriers, figure out recommendations to improve that, but this would go a long way in making sure that all our children are doing successful in school.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Finstad, or the testifier, the one thing that I noted when I read this detailed proposed piece of legislation, the one paragraph, is I wrote a note. How big is this task force going to be? And in the other legislation that I read that proposes this sort of thing, I give you an example: the social services licensing bill that's going through. We specify exactly how many members from what walks of life. And Sue, you just mentioned attorneys, and I don't see the attorneys mentioned anywhere in here. So my question is, why not put some parameters on it?
Representative Emmer, that was not an oversight.
I'm sorry. Ms. Abderholden?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you know, we were trying not to be too prescriptive. Other people can clearly be added if their expertise is needed. We thought with representing from the school boards, they're getting some of the direct information from some of the attorneys on this issue. We'd also like to hear from school districts where they've done it well and be able to talk to their school boards as well. So I don't think it's restrictive at all. Others can certainly be added. But we wanted to make sure that some of the main players who have a stake in how this is done would be at the table. Our mental health action group has brought in folks. There have been a number of people who participated in the subcommittee, and when a particular expertise is needed, we certainly brought them in.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just a note of concern. This is a great idea, and it needs to happen, but I have a concern when it's not defined that maybe having served on many different boards of all different sizes and from all different areas of the community, you want to make sure you get something done. So I think you do want to define the board a little bit better and make sure that the board knows what the ultimate goal is and when it's going to be done.
Representative Finstad, I have a hunch that in addition to the next stop, that you may have to make a government stop, and that makeup of the board, it would be certainly an issue that they would be talking to you about as well. Representative Finstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to quickly point out line 7 and 8, line 7 through 9 talks about the discretion to give the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education as they establish this. So our point, like Sue said, was to keep this open on the front end and allow the experts to make more of an educated decision on who would be on this. So.
And I believe, although we don't have it right now, there is a fiscal note to this, and that means that it will come back in the end spot to us. Well, you can check. I was just told that there might be a fiscal note. Michelle?
Mr. Chair, members, there is a fiscal note on this. It is attributed to the Department of Human Services. The impact is listed as $24,000, and what that covers is a half-time person or a person for half-time, depending on how they characterize it. And that's basically for coordination kinds of things. That's what I know.
Well, you can work on that along the way. As it currently stands, we do have a fiscal note. Unless that changes, it would need to come back to this committee for fiscal inclusion. So, okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Finstad renews his motion that House File 1040 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Education Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Kamba. Representative Kamba, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to move House File 838.
No, 235, I believe, is the number.
Oh, sorry.
Representative Kamba moves House File 235. I believe that's made itself, so it would be, I would stay in this committee for possible inclusion.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, for possible inclusion. Representative Kamba, to your bill.
Basically, this is an add-on to the Woman's Right to Know bill. It's called the Unborn Child Prevention Act, and it basically directs a physician who after 20 weeks of the unborn child of 20 weeks or more, they must inform the female that pain is felt by the baby, and so they must at least tell the woman that she has the option of giving an anesthetic to her unborn baby. I have a witness, Jackie Moen from MCCL, who would like to testify.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Sorry, I'm chewing on Representative Tremba's candy here.
Hi. I do have a couple of handouts, too, if the page would like to bring them around. Mr. Chair, members of committee, my name is Jackie Moen, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. MCCL is a grassroots organization that was established 36 years ago to help women and their unborn children. As Minnesota's largest pro-life organization, we have grown to more than 77,000 member families and 241 chapters across our state. Thank you for allowing me to speak here today. I come before you to urge you to pass House File 235, the Unborn Child Pain Prevention Act. In 2003, the Minnesota legislature passed the Woman's Right to Know law. Under this law, a woman must be given information regarding her unborn child's capacity to feel pain at 20 weeks gestation and after. The Unborn Child Pain Prevention Act would require that the physician inform a woman seeking an abortion at 20 weeks or more of the availability of administering pain-reducing drugs directly to the unborn child. There is strong consensus within the medical community that unborn babies at 20 weeks can feel pain. Dr. Vincent J. Collins, professor of anesthesiology, has stated, as early as 8 to 10 weeks gestation and definitely by 13 and a half weeks, the human fetus experiences organic pain. Dr. David Birnbach, president of the Society for Obstetric Anesthesia and Perinatology and self-described as pro-choice, stated in testimony before the United States Congress, on occasion, we need to administer anesthesia directly to the fetus because even at these early gestational ages, the fetus moves away from the pain of the stimulation. Dr. Stephen Calvin, perinatologist at the University of Minnesota, has stated the neural pathways are present for pain to be experienced quite early by unborn babies. Not only are unborn babies capable of feeling pain, but many physicians agree that unborn babies experience a much more intense pain than they would after birth. Dr. Jean A. Wright, Division Director of Pediatric Critical Care and Emergency Medicine at Emory University School of Medicine, has written, it is likely that the threshold for such pain perception is lower than that of older preterm newborns, full-term newborns, and older age groups. Thus, the pain experienced during partial birth abortions by the human fetus would have a much greater intensity than any similar procedures performed in older age groups. Unborn babies deserve the consideration of being given anesthesia before they are aborted. In fact, an unborn child currently has less legal protection from inflicted pain than commercial livestock. In a slaughterhouse, a method of slaughter is deemed legally humane only if all animals are rendered insensible to pain by a single blow or gunshot or an electrical, chemical, or other means that is rapid and effective before being shackled, hoisted, thrown, cast, or cut. By contrast, D&E abortions performed as late as 24 weeks, well after the child is able to feel pain, involve dismemberment of the unborn child by a pair of sharp metal forceps. Installation methods of abortion, performed even in the third trimester, involve replacement of up to 1 cup of amniotic fluid with a concentrated saline solution, which the unborn child inhales as the salt burns her skin. The child lives in this condition for an hour or longer. In neither of these techniques is the unborn child provided with any form of anesthesia to reduce the suffering. In a Zogby poll conducted in April 2004, the public supported laws requiring that women who are 20 weeks or more along in the pregnancy be given information about fetal pain before having an abortion by a 77% to 16% margin. The Minnesota legislature can and should act to prevent, to the greatest extent possible, terrible suffering from being inflicted on unborn children by partial birth abortions and by D&E procedures that dismember them by brute force while they are still alive. House File 235 would be a worthwhile step in that direction. On behalf of the over 77,000 member families and 241 chapters of MCCL, I urge you to support House File 235. Thank you for your time, and I will stand for any questions.
Thank you. Representative Goodman.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Otremba, maybe counsel can answer this for me. On page 1, line 21, the description of unborn child means a member of the species Homo sapiens from fertilization until birth. Is that in current law anywhere? Are we defining an unborn child from fertilization in current law?
Representative Trumbo? Ms. Mullen?
That is the current term that's used with past bills, with the Women's Right to Know bill as well. That's already in law.
That's already in statute. Can I get that? Is it? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. No further discussion, then we do have an additional testifier. Do you have any additional testifiers, President Otremba?
No.
Okay, I think there was somebody else that wished to testify. Mr. Renner?
I know. I thought so yesterday. Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association. Let me first state that, again, as I've said in the past, the Minnesota Medical Association does not have a position on abortion. We have physicians who are strong pro-life. We have physicians who are strong pro-choice. We have many that are in the middle, somewhere in between. The concern that we have with this bill is dealing with the issues of informed consent. Informed consent is a concept that's crucial. It's key to any medical procedure that the patient knows all benefits and risks prior to that procedure and prior to giving consent. Our concern is in putting in the statute the type of information that must be given in order to receive informed consent. Generally, we want that to be as flexible as possible so that as the science changes, as medicine changes, as the individual physicians and individual patients' situations change, that there's flexibility to allow that change. The other major concern we have with this legislation is the penalty section. The way the bill's drafted right now, there is a felony penalty against any healthcare provider, or the physician or other provider, who does not provide certain information according to how the bill is drafted. As I say, the issues of informed consent, we strongly support. We think that patients should be given all the information necessary. I would also finally say, if we look at the area of abortion, we already have two other sections in state law require informed consent, and we put in a statute that we require it. We question whether we need to add this third section. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Goodman?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have quite a bit of problem with the criminal penalties in here for physicians. It looks like it opens things wide up for lawsuits without
without much evidence being available. What's your MMA's position on that, the criminal penalties in here?
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Goodman, as I said earlier, that's a major concern we have with this legislation. Generally, my understanding, I'm not an attorney nor a criminal attorney, but felony penalties generally are not applied to simply giving the inappropriate information or information that's not dictated in a certain law. So that's a major concern we have with this legislation. Now, that may be more appropriate for a different committee. It may not be in the jurisdiction of this committee, but that's one of our concerns.
Thank you.
President Obama.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Renner, following up on Representative Goodwin's question, in your testimony, the issue, as I understand it, when it comes to informed consent, is that the folks that you represent want to make sure that they know what it is that they're supposed to, they're going to be responsible to communicate. Do I have that correctly?
Mr. Renner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, generally, regardless of the procedure, We have always opposed putting in a statute the type of information that you must give to a patient in order to receive informed consent. One of the main reasons is because each patient is different, each patient, their knowledge base is different, and also the science changes. In the area of fetal pain, the science is changing significantly in that just a few years ago, it was unclear whether there was pain or not. There's more and more now that are saying that potentially, whether it's 20 weeks or 24 weeks. In the area of fetal surgery, there is definitely becoming the standard of care to use anesthesia. But so we have concern whenever you put into statute the specifics of what has to be said in order to receive informed consent.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Renner, I don't know that that's exactly the answer to the question I was asking. Why don't I rephrase it?
Okay.
Subdivision 2 of the proposed legislation, you've read it, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
It's fairly clear in that subdivision that a physician is going to be charged with a very specific and narrow responsibility. Wouldn't you agree with me,
Mr. Arnold?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I believe I agree with you. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that is just to advise the patient about the risks associated and the fact that there's the anesthetic available.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, but again, what I would argue is that when we put in the statute as an example, and I'm not a scientist either, I will make that very clear, that we're talking about that gestational age of 20 weeks. What happens if the science now changes and says that, you know, maybe it's 18 weeks or maybe it's 22 weeks? Whenever we start putting in the specifics of what has to be said and how it has to be said, we oppose that regardless of the procedure.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Renner, I do appreciate that, but perhaps we just have a genuine disagreement because it seems to me that by putting that 20-week threshold in and making it very clear what is required, that in fact you're protecting the people that you're representing by making it clear to them that they won't get surprised as long as they follow this.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for the author, I guess, and for this witness, but for the author, why was felony instead of misdemeanor chosen here? I know that in the other informed consent related to abortion, it's a misdemeanor as opposed to a felony. I was just wondering what the rationale for that was.
Ms. Mung?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thiessen, this was the informed consent penalty of a felony was previously used in the old informed consent laws, and so we are following up with that. We also need to remember that this is an unborn child that we're talking about that is capable of feeling pain. And I would just like to go back to also the question talking about what was set up for the 20 weeks that the unborn child can feel pain that the previous testifier talked about. We're establishing a minimum criteria here, and that's the minimum age they can, or the minimum where they can start talking about this. As we go on and science develops and we know that unborn children can feel pain earlier and earlier, we can let them know that, but they must stay at 20 weeks because there is a strong consensus that the unborn child can feel pain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, so on the first point, the original informed consent law said felony, but what's current law?
Current law for informed consent? Sorry.
That's right.
Yes.
It is not a felony.
It's a misdemeanor, is that, Mr. Chair? It's a misdemeanor.
Representative Thiessen.
Well, I can say I have the statute in front of me, and it's a misdemeanor. We don't have to do it.
Okay.
Even though Representative Emmer likes those cross examinations, which she's very good at, we don't need to do that. So again, would just come back and to the point, Mr. Chair, of that this is pain to the unborn child. But the point of the criminal thing is it has to do with the information provided. It doesn't have to do with performing the procedure. And so I think the analogy is closer to the informed consent under the consent for minors for health services as opposed to having to do with like an assault type of penalty. So I was just, I guess if I could, Mr. Chair, I know that I'm not following the rule, but I was wondering if I could offer an oral amendment of one word to say felony to misdemeanor.
Reverend Thiessen, could I ask you maybe just to hold for a bit until could we have a couple more people that had some discussion? Then I'll come back to you.
Fine, sure.
Okay.
Could I get a reaction from the author on that, though? Would that be possible?
That's fair enough. Representative Tremblay, you have any reaction to the possibility of an amendment?
Mr. Chair, members are free to present whatever amendments they would choose to.
And that's fair. Okay. I should have done that.
What did you expect? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question for Mr. Renner.
You're going to delay this until we'll never get to the other.
If we could put an extra chair or two there in case we have other testifiers. Please proceed. Go ahead.
First of all, how many members are in the MMA right now?
Mr. Renner?
Mr. Chair and members, we have over 10,000 members in the Medical Association.
And when you...
Representative Dean.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Mr. Renner. When you issue these stances, how does that come about? How do you generate those?
Mr. Renner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, we have a democratic process through our association where we have a committee process where issues go through committees and then they go to our board of trustees. Our board of trustees is what sets our policy.
And specifically to this bill, Mr. Renner, there's basically three pieces to this. There's should we or should we not administer anesthetic to the unborn child, number one. Number two, the informed consent piece. And number three, the penalty piece. You issued the MMA's position on the informed consent piece, which you oppose, and the penalty piece, which you oppose for the reasons that you stated. Mm-hmm. But you didn't say was the MMA's position on whether or not it's a good idea to give anesthetic to the unborn babies. But you did say that it's a standard of practice in the profession. So I'm wondering if the MMA does then have a position that it's a good idea to administer anesthetic to the unborn baby.
Mr. Renner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, we did not take a position on this bill based on whether it is right or not to give anesthesia, mainly because we didn't have the expertise within our committee. Our concern was about the patient-physician relationship. What I mentioned earlier, my understanding, and to be honest, this is something that we're learning more about because it is an emerging area, where it is becoming, as I understand, more of a standard is in the area of fetal surgery. In situations where there is an anomaly or something wrong with the fetus, and prior to birth, there is surgery to correct that. My understanding in those situations, it is becoming more standard to provide anesthesia as early as 20 weeks. I don't know what the standard is regarding abortion.
I appreciate that, and I'm fascinated with fetal surgery. I think it's absolutely amazing what your folks can do, and I think that type of legislation should be a good informant of how to approach this important issue as well. So that's just my comment. Thank you.
Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to make a quick comment and applaud Representative Tremba and her efforts on this bill, and thank her for bringing this before us today. Just a quick personal story. The first time my wife and I are expecting, I say this all the time, but the first time she told me the baby was kicking, I felt my wife's belly, and it kicked, and then I pushed a little back, and then the baby would kick, and I pushed a little back, and the baby would kick. So to me, I mean, it's not even a question of if they feel pain or if they feel, because that to me was the personal, all the personal experience I needed, that the baby does feel what's going on and know what's going on. This is a good bill, and I ask for a roll call.
Your roll call has been requested. Representative Pippin.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Beeson, I'm not a lawyer, so you'll have to forgive me, but I was reviewing with Representative Emmer statute number 609.2661, and it continues through several sections, and I'm thinking that you might want to read that over before you offer it. The section 609.2662 is titled Murder of an Unborn Child in the Second Degree, and lists the penalties, including not more than 40 years imprisonment, and that's for second degree. And yeah, and I was wondering if you would be wanting to, if your amendment would address that section to change that as well, or
no?
Representative,
and I think that goes back to the point I was trying to make before, which was that is a violent crime, and I know there's people that would consider it, but what this is getting to is a doctor. It's a penalty for a doctor either providing consent or not. The penalty has nothing to do with whether an abortion is performed or not. And I think that's an important distinction to be made here. So I think it's more closer to the informed consent law than it is to murder. And I don't want to, you know, anyway, thank you.
I think we've had, well, I'm sorry, Representative Pepper.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that in that section it says, you may be sentenced to imprisonment for not more than 40 years. Anyone who causes the death of an unborn child with intent to affect the death of that unborn child. So I'm a little confused at the language. Of course, I'm not an attorney, but I would think that that amendment would be an unfriendly amendment, seeing as how that would seem to affect a lot of the current statute.
Well, I think it's time to present this.
I think I made my point on that. So.
You made your point.
Thanks.
So you don't...
I do think it is closer to informed consent than a criminal.
Right. Why don't you go ahead and offer your amendment?
I will. I have to change on page 2, line 19, change the word felony to misdemeanor.
If the petition moves to amend House File 235 on page 2, line 19, to change the word felony to misdemeanor. You all understand that motion, that amendment. Discussion of the amendment. Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to speak in favor of the amendment. I think this would be a first. This would be a first, I think, and I don't know where anywhere else in statute, but again, I'm not an attorney either, where we make something a felony for what somebody said or didn't say. And this would be a real... I think detrimental to good public policy making to start doing this. It's overboard. So I speak in favor of this amendment.
For discussion to the member, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, just for Representative Pepin, sometimes our laws don't abide by the national constitution. In that case, what you're referring to is a procedure that is protected by the Constitution of the United States.
Representative Rotremba, Ms. Moan, did you have advice to the committee, your reaction? Representative Rotremba.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote against the amendment.
Further discussion? Seeing none, we'll vote, proceed to vote on the amendment to change felony to misdemeanor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Chair's in doubt. Let's try it again. All those in favor of substituting misdemeanor for felony say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. I think we've had considerable discussion. Representative Trumbo renews. I'm sorry. We had a roll call requested. Roll call is taken. This is on the bill.
Bradley?
Yes.
Hempstead?
Yes.
Abler?
Yes.
Dean?
Yes.
Eakin?
Yes.
Emmer?
Yes.
Goodwin?
No.
Huntley?
No.
Otremba?
Yes.
Heppen?
Yes.
Powell?
Yes.
Samuelson?
Yes.
Tau? Beeson?
No.
Walker?
No.
Wilkin?
Yes.
not here.
There have been 11 ayes, 4 nays. The motion is adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Representative Smith. As Representative Smith moves forward, I'll move House File 226 for possible inclusion in the Health Omnibus Finance Bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a question on procedure. I know on the next bill that's coming, there's some people that have traveled here to testify on that, and we're running out of time. I was wondering if we could flip those bills around so that they at least would have a chance to testify.
Well, we also have a member who's come from another committee and activities too, so I guess we've gotten started here. We'll have to see. I think people know where they're going to vote on these bills, and we can maybe shorten our debate a little bit and move on.
That's fine. Okay, they're just out of the testimony. So
I understand
that.
We can
keep that in mind. Thanks.
Yep, I appreciate that. Representative Smith, through your bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and committee members. I'm going to briefly walk you through the bill, then reference the fiscal note, if you will. First of all, a general description. The Minnesota legislature has passed a parental notification bill back in 1981, so it is current legislative policy for the last 24 years to require parental notification in the event of an abortion. The law requires that an abortion may not be performed on a minor unless parents are given 48 hours notice or the minor receives permission from a court for the abortion. That's called a judicial bypass. A minor can receive a judicial bypass if she is found to be a mature and capable of giving informed consent, or if notifying her parents would not be in her best interest, such as in the cases of abuse. This bill before you is a parental notification data bill, and it would allow the legislature to monitor how effectively the notification law is being implemented. If you care to look at House File 226, the bill requires in subdivision 1 that the Commission of Health will prepare a reporting form for use by physicians and facilities performing abortions. The form will require the following information: the number of minors or women for whom a guardian has been appointed, the number of notices provided personally and or provided by mail. On page 2, if you'll follow me, it also requires to contain the number who went on to obtain the abortion from the reporting physician or the reporting physician's facility, the number of minors or women for whom a guardian has been appointed, and the number who were emancipated minors. The required information would also include county of residence, age, race, the process the physician or physician's agent used to inform the female of the judicial bypass, and whether court forms were provided to her. The submission of the report would be required, and the commissioner would maintain the confidential data, which would be confidential so as to not lead to the identification of the individual, etc. In other words, it's calling for aggregate data, not for identification of anyone. On page 3 of the bill, there are provisions for in the case of failing to report, for example, any report not submitted more than 30 days following its due date would be subject to a $500 penalty. There also is provision for the Commissioner of Health to file a motion in court for requiring the information, and there's also a provision for allowing a number of individuals to seek that permission if the department does not. It makes the data private on page 4. There is provision under the public records section, subdivision 5 on that page, again, that by September 30 the information would have to be provided in containing the total number, the number of cases also where a guardian ad litem was appointed, the number of cases where there was counsel. And that, Mr. Chairman, is it. You'll notice the fiscal note, at least the one that I have, indicates that it requires a 0.8 of a person 0.4 management analyst 4, 0.1 ITS programmer, 0.ITS, 0.1 ITS database, 0.2 OAS. So I believe the cost is listed in the fiscal note. Mr. Chairman, one other note. I would just add a personal comment. Bill is not creating policy, it's addressing policy that has existed since 1981, legislative policy, requirement of notice to parents. The bill was passed in 1981, was in the best interest of parents and children in this state, except the bill lacked one thing, that lacked the required machinery within that bill to allow this, to allow the legislature to do what its job is, and that is to oversee and to track its bills. I don't think anyone on this committee was here when the 1981 law was passed. I know I was not. I think we've improved since then in passing legislation that requires reporting, mandated reporting back to the legislature. I just checked the web and found 56 mandated reports ranging from required information on sustainable forest resources, renewable hydrogen resources, surface water quality. Sports Facility Commission requires a report, animal feedlots, and adverse health events. I think that the issue of notice of performing abortions on minors should also have had this in 1981, and that's the sum total of the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. You wish to testify if you'd introduce it. And if I can ask, we do have another important bill before us with a number of testifiers, so if we can be as brief as possible, I'd appreciate it. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura Giese, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. Thank you for allowing me to speak here today. I will keep my comments brief. I come before you to urge you to pass House File 226, the Parental Notification Data Bill. The Minnesota Legislature passed the Parental Notification Law in 1981, as Representative Smith has said, and it was later upheld by the United States Supreme Court. The law requires that an abortion may not be performed on a minor unless her parents are given 48 hours notice or the minor receives permission from a court for the abortion, which is referred to as a judicial bypass. The minor can receive the bypass if she is found to be immature and capable of giving informed consent or if notifying her parents would not be in her best interest, as Representative Smith said, as in cases of abuse. House File 226, the Parental Notification Data Bill, would provide a monitoring mechanism for how effectively the bypass part of the parental notice law is being implemented. It will also enable the state to be aware of counties overburdened with judicial bypass procedures. Minnesota has already determined that the state has an interest in trying to involve parents in their minor daughter's abortion. It would only naturally follow that the state has an interest in making sure that this important law is working. Please support House File 226. Thank you, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. See no questions. We have another testifier that wishes to testify, I think in opposition, Tim Stanley. And I would make the same request of you in respect to the next bill if we have. Welcome to the committee.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Stanley, and I am the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota, the state affiliate of the National of NARAL Pro-Choice America. I testify today on behalf of our members and Minnesota's pro-choice majority. NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota is the state's largest grassroots advocacy organization dedicated to defending the reproductive rights of all Minnesotans. NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota strenuously objects to House File 226. This bill goes way beyond what is necessary to ensure that judges and clinics are obeying the requirements of Minnesota's rigid two-parent notification law. House File 226 is an anti-choice attempt to further restrict young women's access to privacy. The U.S. Supreme Court has firmly established that minors must be given a confidential, fair, and expeditious alternative to parental notification for abortion. In Minnesota, that alternative is a judicial bypass. House File 226 requires detailed information about the number of judicial bypasses granted in each county. This is nothing more than an effort to target judges who are simply following the law by granting bypasses to young women who are sufficiently mature and well-informed or for whom a bypass is in their best interest. After efforts such as House File 226 could further impede access to reproductive health care for young women by targeting judges who grant judicial bypasses and making these judges think twice before granting a judicial bypass to a young woman. Such a chilling effect would most certainly unduly burden young women seeking to avail themselves of their constitutional right to choose. Regrettably, violence has recently struck a courtroom in Atlanta and the home of a judge in Chicago. These attention-grabbing events shouldn't desensitize us to the sensitivity of judicial proceedings. We believe that the safety of state judges should be taken under consideration and that the legislature should do everything possible to protect the well-being of our judiciary rather than passing legislation that targets certain judges. As legislators continue to introduce anti-choice and anti-privacy measures year after year, we will continue to oppose them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Emmer, do you have a...
I do. Very, very brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stanley, you just testified that it's very important that this information not be collected because the system's supposed to work to take care of young women who, in your words, I wrote them down, is sufficiently mature. Mm-hmm. In the last committee that this bill was presented, the Civil Law Committee, there was a guardian ad litem who testified in place of you, who said, number one, that she is 5 years in Hennepin County. Number two, and I think this came out in a subsequent committee, that she has processed hundreds of these. Number three, that only one in her 5 years has been denied the parental notification. And the most concerning statement was that the youngest female that she helped through the system was 12 years old. Sir, what to you constitutes, what age would be, the youngest age would be sufficiently mature in your eyes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Denver, thank you. I can't speak to anything that the other testifier spoke to. I heard her give her testimony, did not transcribe it, do not know exactly word for word what she said. However, I would say that the intimacy and the intimacy of the judicial bypass procedure is such that the judge is the one who makes that determination. I am not able to make that call, and neither is any of the elected officials at this table.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stanley, I'd respectfully disagree with you, sir.
I thought you might. Members, we do have an amendment in our packet if there's someone who wants to an offer.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to offer that now, but I will say that we have another bill coming up, and there's 9 witnesses signed up. I have a substantial amendment, and we have the right to offer amendments. We have the right to discuss bills fully, and I don't know how we're going to get that done in 20 minutes.
Well, that's the next piece of business, so we'll get to that when we get to it. I can ask the committee's opinion on it.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Walker.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for Representative Smith. It was helpful that you noted some of the other things that we do have reports back to us. I'm curious on the gathering of the information and what we will do with it once we gather it. Have you put any thought to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, I'm interested in carrying this bill. I'm interested in the information that it requires to be collected, aggregate data, personally, and maybe even as a legislature. I don't care to know names. I do want to know numbers. And as a mandated report to the legislature so that we can assess in our opinions as legislators how well the 1981 law is working or isn't. So it's a desire for that information.
Representative Walker.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Smith, that was just partial of the question. The evaluation of the 1981 law, I think, was the partial of answering my question. And because it's your bill, so I'm assuming that you've had some time to process your thoughts, the reason why you're bringing this forward, trying to evaluate. Once we evaluate, say we find out, and I'll use Hennepin County since I'm from Hennepin County, that in a particular year we've granted 500 judicial bypasses for minor children. Since we're doing it by county, have you put any thought to what you would like to do with this particular information once you have evaluated with the law if it's working or not? The purpose of the law was to make sure that we have another avenue for minor children who did not have necessarily different barriers or circumstances depending on that individual with their own parental household to be able to go to an outside party and to go through a judicial bypass to make sure that they had an option that they were speaking out for, correct?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, let me just, and Representative Walker, let me just, in about one or two sentences, summarize my reason for carrying this bill. I think the 81 law is good because it serves the best interests of both the parents and the minor. It gives the parents notice, and it gives a judicial bypass if to do that would contribute to any abuse of that child. So I think and I want the legislature to determine how well the law is working. So that's my reason.
Mr. Chair,
President Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just close with this because I do know we have testifiers for the next bill. I don't want to get necessarily at the intent of why you're bringing this bill forward, Representative Smith. I'm just actually more interested in the down the line of where, what we do with information. We often do studies. We do collect data for different reasons. And a lot of times we don't have the thought of what we're collecting them for. So we spend money, collect data, and then what? And so I'll stop there, and I guess I'll just give you some time to think about it, and if the bill passes this committee and makes it to the floor, we can discuss it more on the floor. Thank you.
No further discussion. I'll renew my motion that House File 226 be held over for possible inclusion. Representative Dean?
Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. We'll take roll.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin.
First, somebody call. Representative Goodwin.
Are we starting now to take votes on bills that are going to be held over for possible inclusion? We haven't done that.
Representative Goodwin, it's a fair question, and we've had a mixed bag. I've used sort of the prerogative of the chair when I felt as though there really wasn't a concern. The committee seemed to have a consensus to just let the chair move it. But at any point, of course, members have the right to call for a vote or a roll call. There was a motion before us, and members have a right to do that.
Well, thank you. I wish I would have known that earlier, Mr. Chair.
Huh? You have that right? Go ahead. Please proceed with the roll call.
Bradley?
Yes.
Hempstead?
Yes.
Abler?
Yes.
Dean?
Yes.
Eakin?
Yes.
Hammer?
Yes.
Goodwin?
No.
Huntley?
No.
Otemba?
Yes.
Pepin?
Yes.
Powell?
Yes.
Samuelson?
Yes.
Tao?
No.
Eason?
No.
Walker?
No.
Wilkins?
Yes.
There have been 11 ayes and 5 nays. The motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you. Mr. Smith. Members, what I'm going to try to do, we may not get to the amendments, and Representative Huntley, I respect your admonition. We'll do the best we can. We did tell the sides that we would limit because we had quite a number of people, but I have a hunch that the testimony would begin to be repetitious and ask them to keep within 10 minutes. Representative Blaine, if you and your testifier are able to squeeze your time down a little bit, my hunch is that members pretty much know where they're going to vote, but I realize there are people who want to testify. That would still allow us to have 10 minutes for the opponents to testify, and it's up to them to sort of keep within that. I will move House File 227 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Health Finance Bill. Representative Black, welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm very happy to be here today and very happy to be carrying House File 227, the Taxpayers Protection Act. I think most of the members in this committee are familiar with this piece of legislation, and I will be very brief and to the point, and I would just as soon we motor right along here. So, members, I'm going to go through the contents of the bill here, and I also have Andrea Ralph from Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life, who I'm sure would like to say a few words on behalf of House File 227. Members, if you look at the bill, Section 1, family planning grants, not use subsidized abortion services. This limits the use and eligibility for family planning grants and establishes the application of requirements. Subdivision 1, it basically gives us the definition. Subdivision 2 states the use of family planning grants. Subdivision 3 of Section 1 talks about the organizations receiving family planning grant funds. Subdivision 4 is the independent affiliates that provide abortion services. Subdivision 5 deals with independent audits. Subdivision 6 of this bill deals with Title 10 funds, federal money, and Subdivision 7 is the severability part of this bill. Mr. Chairman and members, this bill is not of great length, and I think everybody here has probably seen this bill before. But everyone here is aware, too, this bill was passed off the House floor in the previous biennium. With that, Mr. Chairman, in the respect of time, I would ask that Andrea Rao be allowed to speak.
Ms. Rao, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Rao, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, a grassroots organization of more than 77,000 member families and over 240 chapters across the state. Thank you for allowing me to speak here today. I will try to be brief. In the U.S. Supreme Court case, Russ v. Sullivan, decided in 1991, the United States Supreme Court ruled, when the government appropriates funds to establish a program, it is entitled to define the limits of the program. Today's debate is not about whether or not preventing unintended pregnancies is a worthy cause. However, family planning programs have expanded, intentionally or not, to include subsidies for abortion. Today, every taxpayer is funding abortion in our state. Through family planning programs, abortion providers and advocates are receiving millions of dollars. These dollars become a subsidy that makes it easier to maintain and expand buildings, provide maintenance, and even to provide abortion services. Some will claim that House File 227 will limit or restrict the abortion industry from providing their services. This is simply not true. Those who currently make money from abortion will still be able to do all that they currently do, including providing family planning services and abortion services. It's just that with the enactment of this bill, they will no longer receive your and my tax money to do their work. This legislation is about removing a subsidy from the abortion industry and has nothing to do with legitimate access to health care. The abortion industry in Minnesota has become a big business, with revenues in excess of $6 million. In 2003, 14,024 unborn Minnesotans lost their lives to abortion. Even if you are supportive of abortion, and consequently the roughly half million Minnesota lives lost to abortion since Roe v. Wade, can you justify to your constituents the expenditure of their tax dollars for such an industry? The question that is addressed with House File 227 is whether or not the taxpayers should be forced to fund a multi-million dollar abortion industry, or should the state of Minnesota remove itself from the battle of abortion. Abortion advocates claim that family planning must include abortion counseling and referrals. This claim was the basis for the previously mentioned U.S. Supreme Court case, Russ v. Sullivan. In that case, a New York affiliate of Planned Parenthood argued that the federal Title X program violated certain rights, including the First Amendment right to free speech, by barring abortion counseling and referrals under the federal grants from Title X. The law was upheld. Each year, the legislature examines how and where to spend Minnesota tax dollars. When the hardworking families of Minnesota dutifully pay their taxes, they are expecting that you, as a legislature, will make wise choices. Most would say that subsidizing abortion is not a wise use of their money. Time and time again, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life has come before this body to ask for the restoration of protection for all human life. Today, we merely ask that you remove your subsidies to a business that the vast majority of Minnesotans are opposed to. It is a legitimate exercise of the government to make sure that the programs it subsidizes with taxpayers' money are limited to the uses for which they were established. MCCL and Minnesota's pro-life majority urge your support for passage of House File 227. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Blaine, we have two amendments, at least in the packet. If I understood right, I just wanted to verify that you would be in favor of those two amendments. Did I hear that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, if you could tell me which two amendments.
A1 and A2.
The H0227 A1 and A2 amendments. Mr. Chairman and members, I have reviewed these amendments, and I consider them to be friendly amendments.
Okay. Well, it might be good, members, that we could process that quickly. I think since it doesn't seem to be any disagreement, we can have that done so our packets will be a little bit easier if we do have to come back to it. The authors of A1, A2, A1 first wish to make that amendments?
Which one is?
Huntley, is that,
well, Mr. Chair, the way the bill is currently written, it would affect roughly $50 million of medical education money that goes to various institutions across the state, including, I must say, $14.5 million to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Mr. Chair. And all these institutions that receive this money have family practice residencies, and I've handed out some things that show that if you have a family practice residency, you will teach about abortion. You will teach about these procedures. Those are national regulations. Any resident programs that or medical programs that have family practice residency, OBGYN, internal medicine, probably pediatrics as well, are required to teach these as part of the continuum of women's health care. I don't think the intent of this bill was to deny those funds, so I would urge that we support this amendment.
Representative Huntley moves Amendment A1. I think we have agreement from the author. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion to bail. Amendment A1 is adopted. Amendment A2.
Representative
Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A2 amendment just to give the new members and Representative Blaine, who's just carrying this bill for a while. We have seen this bill the last few years, and there's always the language of the health disparities and making sure that we just take that piece out. We're doing some great work across the state with eliminating health disparities in communities of color and wanting to make sure that there isn't that piece in it. There actually isn't family planning that the grants themselves have been working on. They've been working on a wide variety of other health disparities.
I think the author is accepting this as clarifying language. All those in favor of Amendment A2 say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion fails. Amendments are adopted. I believe that completes your testimony. We do have a number of people. We will have to do a hard stop at 11:30 so we can all rush over to session. So I would ask those, we have quite a list of people who wanted to testify, and we're going to have about 10 minutes, so I think you just have to respect each other if there's repetition of the message. So, Christian Clayton, first of all.
Mr. Chair.
President Huntley.
Well, some of us might want to discuss this bill as well. So
I think that's fair. When we complete this testimony, we have to hold over and have discussion, and that's a fair point. But I think in deference to the people who've come, I'd like to get this testimony done. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for your time today. My name is Kirsten Clavin, and thank you for this opportunity to listen to me and hear my testimony. It's very important to me to be here today, and my first time participating, giving testimony. Very exciting. So I'm here today to testify in opposition to this bill. I'm a 24-year-old St. Paul resident and committed that women like me continue to have access to affordable health care and family planning services. I oppose this because the bill would restrict state funds from going to quality health care providers like Planned Parenthood. After graduating from college, I had very limited insurance coverage and went to Planned Parenthood for affordable health care. I am committed that low-income women continue to have access to women's health services like cancer screening that might be vital to her health. This bill also restricts what a doctor or nurse could say to their patients. I believe the government shouldn't be telling doctors what they can and can't say. Women have the right to be informed about all options related to their health and well-being. For these reasons, I'm opposed to House File 227. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for providing me the opportunity to testify today. I urge you to vote against House File 227.
Thank you. For a first time, you handled yourself extremely well. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tina Welke. I'm also very honored to be here, my first time as well. Thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony. I'm here today to testify in opposition to this bill. I'm a 29-year-old woman who has not only utilized services from Planned Parenthood, but also believes very strongly in an individual's right to access family planning services. It is imperative that women and men of all income brackets and levels of education have access to services such as basic health care, birth control options, and medically accurate information, including education and prevention of sexually transmitted infections. Planned Parenthood very effectively helps people make responsible choices about their own bodies. Specifically speaking from a woman's point of view, restricting a woman's access to health care, including family planning services, is denying her the right to make choices about her own body, including prevention of pregnancy. I oppose House File 227 because this bill would restrict state funds from going to quality health care providers such as Planned Parenthood. Alternatively, this bill would do nothing to reduce unintended pregnancy or abortion. I believe it would have the opposite effect in that it would restrict a woman's access to health care, would make it more difficult for her to get the services she needs. For these reasons, I'm opposed to House File 227. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for providing me this opportunity to testify today. I urge you to vote against House File 227. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in opposition to House File 227. My name is Marion Green. I'm a businesswoman working for a Fortune 500 company in the Twin Cities. When I was 21, I made my first visit to a Planned Parenthood clinic in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. At the time, I was a college student working for the summer in a new town and unable to afford a visit to a private doctor. I wanted to have an annual checkup, and my boyfriend and I had also decided to research birth control options. When I was 26, I visited a Planned Parenthood on Central Avenue in Albuquerque, New Mexico. At that time, I was working full-time, but not getting benefits through work and could only afford major medical health insurance. I needed to have an annual checkup and knew that Planned Parenthood and clinics like that took income into account when writing up their bills. Planned Parenthood and programs like it stand for access. They are there for me and others like me when other health care options are unaffordable. They are a safety net. I urge you to vote against House File 227 today.
Thank you for your testimony. Good morning, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm here to testify against House File 227. My name is Barti Wahi, and I'm here to tell you about my experience as a young uninsured woman and the services I was able to utilize at Family Tree Clinic. In the early 1990s, I was a student at the College of St. Catharines. My parents, who were self-employed, had to change insurance carriers during this time, and I was no longer able to be covered under their plan. However, I was able to obtain low-cost family planning services at Family Tree Clinic. Family Tree serves men, women, and adolescents for birth control services, testing, and treatment of sexually transmitted infections, pregnancy diagnosis and counseling, HIV testing, routine pelvic and breast exams, and annual health care maintenance exams. Without Family Tree, I would not have been able to afford any medical services during my undergraduate and early working years. I was treated professionally and with respect. Many other students that I knew at that time also utilized their services. It was really their only option for medical treatment. Almost 14 years later, Family Tree and other family planning clinics are still greatly needed to provide important medical and educational services to countless young women who are uninsured or underinsured in the state of Minnesota. Pregnancy and STD prevention are, as well as other family planning services, are key components to women's health. These clinics need your support and to continue to provide the high-quality medical services that many women depend upon. I really urge you to oppose House File 227. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome.
I'm Rebecca Chutsky, sir. I'm a medical student at the University of Minnesota, and I'm also a mother. This is Josh and Brian, and we co-wrote this statement together. As medical students at the University of Minnesota, we are very concerned with policies that will impact our ability to provide quality, comprehensive care for our patients. Minnesota currently lacks primary care physicians, OBGYNs, and family practitioners, especially in our rural and our low-income communities. In deciding where we, as future primary care providers, will practice medicine, we look at the legal climate of the state. Legislation like HF 227 will work to prevent clinics and practitioners from providing the highest quality, comprehensive reproductive services to our most underserved communities. This kind of legislation weighs heavily in our decision whether or not we want to remain in a state like this throughout our careers in medicine. Medical students at the University of Minnesota are opposed to House File 227 and further legislation restricting our ability to provide quality care to our patients.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Heaney, and thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony on House File 227. I'm here today to testify in opposition to this bill. I'm a senior graduating from Monona State University in May with a degree in community health education, and I am also a current patient at SEMTEC. I oppose House File 227 because every day as I work in the field for my work experience internship, I see just how much quality health care is needed for low-income men and women, children, teenagers. It's very important that they get this. I personally utilize family planning clinics. I am a full-time student working full-time and supporting myself as I do not have family members that are able to help me pay for my schooling and my career. So without clinics such as Planned Parenthood, Family Tree, and SEMTAC, I would not be able to get the vital care that I need and the screening that I needed, which has helped them catch some changes and possible cervical cancer that I have been diagnosed with. Taking away this funding will not reduce unintended pregnancies and will not solve all of our reproductive rights problems. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is actually Peg LeBoer, but I'm going to be reading a statement from a young woman who could not be here today. My name is Catherine Ansley, and I am the mother of 8-year-old Alexander. I feel that clinics provide family planning for low-income and disadvantaged women are a vital part of our society and community. Further, I feel it is vital that such clinics allow each client they serve to understand the full legal range of services available to them. When I was 19, I went to Planned Parenthood in a rural community. If I had not had the right to hear about all types of birth control available, as well as my options if pregnant, then I would have never made an informed decision about my own reproductive health. To make informed decisions is simply a right of any citizen. Under no circumstances are physicians' oaths ignored and patients kept ignorant about treatment options available to address their situation. The availability of such clinics and the information they give definitely saved my life and allowed me to grow and become a person who could offer the child I now have a much wiser mother and a more fulfilling life because I've had the opportunity to receive an education and build circumstances welcoming to a child. This is something I couldn't have done 15 years ago when I was able to have an abortion, thanks to the publicly funded clinics that allowed an impoverished rural mother to exercise a choice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are you the last testifier?
I am.
Okay,
yes.
Great. We're right on time. You're doing a great job. Thank
you. I'll be quick. And I actually, in lieu of my own testimony, I'm also going to offer a letter that I'll give the members a copy. And this is from Mary Catherine Ricker, a St. Paul teacher. Dear Health and Family Security Committee, thank you so much for taking my testimony. I'm extremely grateful for comprehensive family planning clinics, and I have a unique reason to be. In June of 1998, my husband and I finished teaching in South Korea and prepared to return to the United States. While still overseas, I accepted a job offer from my former school district, and at the end of July, just before flying home, I confirmed that I was pregnant in a hospital in southern Thailand. When I returned to Minnesota in August, I researched my health care benefits with my employer and learned that they would not start until I began working. Because I did not want to wait for prenatal care, I contacted both Family Tree Clinic and the Planned Parenthood Clinic, because I knew both offered comprehensive reproductive care for women. I was immediately relieved by the responses from both clinics. Yes, I should come in and make sure the baby and I were healthy, make sure I was taking the correct prenatal vitamins, and make sure I didn't have any problems from traveling around Southeast Asia. And yes, they could be flexible about billing.
What could have been a very stressful time instead became the first months of a very healthy pregnancy that resulted in a wonderful daughter who turned 6 this month. I was put at ease and well taken care of because a family planning clinic was available to deliver services to women like me, women in unique situations. I am happy that someone trusted these clinics in the past to provide for me when I needed them. We need to support these clinics in their work to keep women healthy and trust women to make their decisions. Thank you so much for your time. And I will just add that I believe these clinics are essential to the health and well-being of young women throughout Minnesota, and they will not be gagged. This bill will, if you pass this bill, it will eliminate the funding to these clinics that do help women throughout Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, and we are really out of time. Members, we will adjourn today, and you better keep your calendars as open as you can next week. We will meet on Tuesday night, probably at 7 o'clock will be our next meeting, and my intention as chair to bring this back for discussion and action of the committee. Any questions, members? If you would please put the items from this particular bill back in your folder so that we can continue to use that. That was done.